Listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. We start off in Studio A with Jimmy Williams, who used to lobby for the powerful National Association of Realtors. And he explains how Congress needs a steady flow of donations and how he wants to take down the crazy campaign finance system. And then on to Studio B, where we have how politicians and their friends get rich off of insider stock tips, land deals, and cronyism that would send the rest of us to prison. Peter Schweitzer explains how members of Congress profit from insider trading and their use of political influence for their own financial gain. And he reports on several members of the House and Senate who have benefited from these techniques.
What I think most people believe who look at this on the issue of tax reform is that you need to close a lot of loopholes that have benefited greatly those who are able to pay lobbyists to get special benefits written into the laws.
Yeah, all painted pallor gray, the storm was coming in. Folks were lining out in all directions.
So, Jacob, are you ready to meet our former lobbyist?
Let's do it.
All right. His name is Jimmy Williams, and he was very much on the inside. In fact, he worked for one of the most powerful lobbies in D.C., the National Association of Realtors.
The realtors were legendary. They're legendary both out in local communities, but they're also legendary in Washington. And when the realtors come to town, I mean, you see them, and they're there, and they swarm Congress. And most other trade associations and most other lobbying outfits and firms know that the week that the realtors are in Washington, D.C., you don't come to Washington that week because there are just so many daggum people in town. I mean, I'm talking tens of thousands of these people come.
Jimmy worked for these people, this legion of realtors that would descend on D.C. every year. He worked there for a number of years, and he lobbied on all kinds of issues. And what I did when I talked to him, I pulled up this list of bills that the National Association of Realtors lobbied on. You can find this stuff online. And I asked him, of these bills, which ones did you lobby personally? It's a long list. I mean, do you recognize any of these?
Let's see. Let's look at them and see. I'll tell you if I worked on them or not. Let's see. Private Property Rights Protection Act. No, I have no clue. I have no idea. Eminent domain, yes. I don't know why the realtors would ever work on the prevention of fraudulent access to phone records, but God only knows. flood insurance, we worked on a lot. Talk about a boondoggle. Flood insurance is horrifying.
All right. So this is one of the things that I loved about talking to Jimmy Williams. You always suspect that maybe lobbyists feel this way, that some of the stuff they're lobbying on is sort of ridiculous. No one actually says it. except Jimmy Williams. So national flood insurance is this government program that provides insurance in places where the private sector won't. But what Jimmy Williams says is the private sector doesn't want to provide flood insurance in these places for good reason.
What the flood insurance program, for all intents and purposes, does at the end is, let's say a hurricane hits your house, and let's say – or you get flooded on the Mississippi River or whatever, which happens every 2 years or whatever. And then – so you have flood insurance. So you get paid because your property has been damaged. Your home has been damaged, right? So what do? You build right in the same damn place. Oh, wait. So then the next year another hurricane comes. And we've just – the federal government, the taxpayer has said for all intents and purposes, we know that you live in a place where hurricanes hit all the time. So why don't you just keep rebuilding there?
Okay. So you, Jimmy Williams, you're a lobbyist and you are lobbying for this thing that fundamentally does not make a lot of sense. How do you go about doing that?
Well, this is where we get to the money, obviously. As a lobbyist, you have what all Congress people need, money. Money to run their campaign for re-election. If you don't have money, you can't get re-elected. So if there was a congressperson Jimmy really needed on his side, he'd raise a bunch of money for that congressperson.
So I call up my buddies down on K Street and I say, hey, dude, from my buddy over at the credit unions or my buddy over at the insurance company or my buddy over wherever – at the home builders. And I say, I'm going to do this event for this guy. And he sits on the House Financial Services Committee. And do you guys have any money for this person? Is he in your budget? And the answer was usually, yeah, I got money for that guy. And so, all right, so cool. So we'll come up with a date. And then we have this fundraiser. And it's a breakfast or it's a lunch or it's a dinner or a cocktail reception or whatever it is. And so then you have it. And everyone comes and they bring their checks or they mail their checks in. And then you sit around. And you have a conversation with the member who's sitting at the head of the table or in the center of the table. And everyone goes around and says, I'm Jimmy Williams and I'm a lobbyist for the National Association of Realtors or whatever it is. And then you go and you say, we care about keeping banks out of – big, bad, evil banks out of real estate. And we care about protecting flood insurance, which is – the flood insurance program, which is great for coastal communities. And we care about keeping the mortgage interest deduction for everybody that can qualify for a mortgage. And, you know – everybody does that. So the insurance guy, the lobbyist for the insurance industry, he does that. And the lobbyist for the accounting industry, she does that. And by the way, the fundraiser is standing in the room.
And Jacob, I should just interrupt you for a second. It gets a little confusing. The event where this is happening is called a fundraiser. And the person raising money for the lawmaker, that person's job title is fundraiser. So both the person and the event are called fundraiser. All right, back to the tape.
And by the way, the fundraiser is standing in the room. And the fundraiser has $35,000 in checks sitting in her pocket right now, in her pocketbook. Oh, and we're going to talk about public policy while we take the checks.
Now, Jimmy says that at these tables, no one ever said, I will do the thing you ask if you give me the money. It was never got that explicit.
Except wasn't there that one congressman a few years back who actually did do – actually made a list and then – well, he went to jail. So I guess most people at least don't do that or we don't know about it.
Exactly. Nobody does that because you know you go to jail. If you write it down, you go to jail.
But I mean – but it seems like just sort of the whole structure of this system you're describing is basically you write a check to get to sit down in a room with the congressman. I mean money equals FaceTime.
Right. And the more money, the more FaceTime. And this is not to say that lawmakers and lobbyists are bad people. In fact, Jimmy says most of them are really decent, good people with principles. Jimmy, like a lot of lobbyists, came to D.C. and worked for a congressman. He was a policy wonk, essentially, and he had ideas about how to make the country better. But lawmakers and lobbyists are all part of this crazy campaign finance system. And to me, it helps conceptually to compare it to the Supreme Court.
Okay, so Supreme Court justices, like lawmakers, they have a lot of power. Often there are wealthy special interests who would really like Supreme Court justices to vote a certain way on a case. But of course, Alex, if some special interest group hired a lobbyist and held a $35,000 fundraiser for a Supreme Court justice, this would be a crazy scandal, right? This doesn't happen.
Right, and what would be a scandal for the Supreme Court is literally routine for Congress. Congress people go to these events that Jimmy Williams is describing, literally morning, noon, and night. And generally, the more high-profile the lawmaker, the more of these things they go to. Nancy Pelosi, for example, her office told NPR's congressional correspondent, Andrea Seabrook, that in 2011, she went to almost 400 fundraisers in 1 year. And that is pretty standard.
And Alex, you've been doing these pieces on lobbying now for a little while. And one of the things that's really been illuminating to me in the pieces is how much the congresspeople themselves need these fundraisers. You know, they need this constant flow of money to get reelected. I mean, in the House, they have to run for reelection every 2 years, and every time they need millions of dollars.
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of people think of it that there are these lobbyists out there and they're just bum-rushing Congress, like throwing money at them and trying to corrupt them with their money. But Jimmy Williams says it's the other way around. Congress people were constantly pestering him, constantly calling. And a lot of times it was Congress people whose votes he didn't even need.
You could look on the phone and you could see it was like a 224 or a 225 number or a 226 number, which are the numbers for the Capitol. And you would be like, really? I'm not taking that call. Hell
no. So you would dodge calls for phone.
Oh, yeah. Every lobbyist does it. Are you kidding? You spend most of your time dodging phone calls. Oh, yeah.
All right. So at this point, you may be wondering, why is this guy telling us all this stuff? What kind of lobbyist actually tells a reporter that the thing he lobbied was a boondoggle and that he went out of his way to dodge calls from lawmakers?
Well, you did say at the top of the show that he's a former lobbyist, right? So he's not still working for the realtors or whatever.
Yeah, and not only is he a former lobbyist, he's a former lobbyist who is now devoting his life to destroying the very system that made him rich. So Jimmy Williams, he doesn't think the problem is lobbyists. He feels like there's always going to be lobbyists. There's always people need to make their case in front of Congress. He doesn't think the problem is lawmakers. You know, obviously we need lawmakers. Generally, they're good people. The problem is how much money politicians need to pay for their campaigns. It all goes back to the money. And to solve this problem, Jimmy Williams wants to go all the way to the source. He wants to change the Constitution itself so that it would become legal to ban money from politics.
And so presumably, Alex, this is because the Supreme Court has ruled many times essentially that money in politics is basically protected by the First Amendment. So even when Congress passes these laws trying to get money out of politics, the Supreme Court keeps more or less striking them down?
Exactly. And there are a lot of people out there, it turns out, who have the same idea. Change the Constitution with a constitutional amendment. Make it possible to pass these laws.
Russell Simmons, the rap guy from Def Jam Records, has a constitutional amendment. Members of Congress have constitutional amendments now. Let's see, who else? Lawrence Lessig, professor from Harvard, has a constitutional amendment. Lots of people have constitutional amendments now. I think there are probably 10 or 12 of them at this point.
And Jimmy's idea is to get together with all these different groups, decide on one amendment, and they all get behind and start pushing it and go about this long, multi-year process of getting Congress to vote on it, getting the states to ratify it, you know. It's pretty crazy, and Jimmy's the first to admit it.
I have absolutely 1,000% lost my mind. There's no doubt about that. And anybody that knows me will tell you, Jimmy is really doing something nuts here. This is crazy talk.
So when people say you lost your mind, why do they say that? What are they saying?
Well, I mean, think about it. You make, you know, for all intents and purposes, $500,000 a year, which is what I made, okay? And you give it up. And then you give it up so you can destroy people making $500,000 a year in Washington, D.C.
To me, the salary that Jimmy is saying goodbye to, that's not the craziest part. To me, it's like the sheer what seems like political innocence of this project. You know what I mean?
Well, you mean like how is this hard-bitten, cynical lobbyist sort of hitching his wagon to the star of a constitutional amendment to get money out of politics?
Yeah, I mean, this is a guy who's been in – he was before he was a lobbyist for 7 years, he was a staffer for 7 years working for a senator. This is a guy who knows the ins and outs of Washington, knows how the sausage is made. And here he is like on this sort of quixotic, idealistic dream, you know? But he says, listen, the country is clearly in a mood. There's high unemployment. There's this lingering housing bust. And approval of Congress is at all-time lows. It's at 9% right now. And he says it's his considered political opinion. There's never been a better time in memory to try something this big.
Well, I don't keep to goings on. I tend to stick with kin. But Watson had it in from the beginning.
We'll have links to our earlier podcasts on lobbying, as well as a link to Jimmy Williams' proposed constitutional amendment on our blog at npr.org/money.
As always, we want to hear what you thought of today's podcast and hear your thoughts in general. Write to us at planetmoney@npr.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. I'm Alex Blumberg.
And I'm Jacob Goldstein. Thanks for listening.
When I was just a little kid, my friends and I'd play war. We'd shoot 'em dead and blow 'em up. Didn't know what we were fighting for. Whenever my dad would see us playing, he'd come and spoil our fun. He'd say, "War is not a game, son. War is not a
I turned 18, I joined the army. Our country was at war. The recruiter said I was a patriot. It was peace I'd be fighting for. I couldn't wait to tell my dad. Thought he'd be proud of what I'd done. But he said, war is always the same, son. War is always the same. Then he put his arms around me and told me things I never heard before. He told me what he'd seen and done when he was in the war. He said, son, I'll always respect you for doing what you thought was right. But the only way that there'll be peace is if we all refuse to fight. Now the army sent me off to war. I was still 18 years old. They taught me how to hate and how to kill and just do what I was told. I could hear my father saying every time I fired my gun, war is not a game, son. War is always the same. I got back from the war alive. My body was intact. I had a son, and as I watched him grow, those old memories came back. He was playing war one day with his friends. Didn't want to spoil his fun, but I said, war is not a game, son. War is always the same. I told my son right then and there things I'd never told him before. I told him what I'd seen and done when I was in the war. I said, son, you're not too young to learn to stand up for what is right. And we can make a better world if we all learn not to fight. Before I knew, my son was 18 and our country was at war again. A recruiter came knocking at our door and asked my son if he could come in. He told my son he'd be a patriot, and it was peace he'd be fighting for. My son said, war is always the same, sir. And then he closed the door.
You can hear great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org. Or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Our guest today is Peter Schweizer. He's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. From 2008 to 2009, he served as a consultant to the White House Office of Presidential Speech Writing. He is also a former consultant to NBC News. Have you lived that down? Among his previous books are The Bushes, Portraits of a Dynasty, Reagan's War, the epic story of his 40-year struggle and final triumph over communism, and Do As I Say, Not As I Do, Profiles in Liberal Hypocrisy. That book, by the way, was on the New York Times bestsellers list for 8 weeks. In fact, and I love this quote, The Economist magazine pronounced Do As I Say the 9th biggest selling political book on the entire planet in November 2005. Additionally, he was executive producer of In the Face of Evil, an epic documentary based on his book, Reagan's War, which won the 2004 Liberty Film Festival. And if you will ask the writer, Steve Bannion, who is here with us today, it's the greatest film ever written. Today, we focus on his newest book here, Throw Them All Out, in which he examines the way the system works on Capitol Hill, or perhaps more aptly, the way Capitol Hill works the system. Please join me in welcoming my friend, Peter. Peter? Thank you.
Thank you, old friend, for that introduction. It's great to be back at the Heritage Foundation and talking about this book. And it's nice to be back in Washington, D.C. I live in Florida, and I don't know how many people here that live in D.C. realize it, but you are now the wealthiest community in the United States. You passed Silicon Valley in terms of net income. So Washington, D.C. has the highest net income. And 7 of the 10 wealthiest counties in the United States are counties that border Washington, D.C. And I think that those two statistics are indicative of the problem that we face today and the subject that I'm here to talk about today, which is, I think, crony capitalism. Now, what do I mean by crony capitalism, and how is it different from free market capitalism? Let me sort of describe it by just giving a couple of archetype examples. Free market capitalism, I would give as an example of that, would be Steve Jobs, the late founder of Apple Computer. He joined what the Occupy Wall Street crowd would call the 1%. By doing what? By creating products and services that people wanted to buy. People desired to buy Apple products. He became very wealthy. That is an example, in my mind, of free market capitalism. Steve Jobs did not have really hardly any lobbyists. He was not active politically. It was a voluntary purchase that people made of his goods and products that made him a very wealthy man. The crony capitalist, on the other hand, is less interested in that voluntary exchange, and they're interested in making money out of the political system. What matters to them is not creating innovative products or services, but having political connections, which allows them to get government contracts, which allows them to get set-asides in the tax codes, guaranteed government loans, guaranteed government grants, and access to inside information that's going to help them on investment decisions. So these, I think, are the two sort of archetypes that exist in America today. And my fear and concern is that we are increasingly moving in the direction of the crony capitalists and away from the free market capitalist, as Steve Jobs being an example. Let me talk about this phenomenon, crony capitalism, in sort of a couple of different areas. First, the people on the inside of the system, which are the politicians, and how they extract their wealth through this crony capitalism. Then I want to talk about the people on the outside that are politically connected and how they are able to effectively milk the system and use their crony connections to enrich themselves at our expense. And then finally, I want to talk about what are some possible solutions and, you know, does this really matter? I mean, we've always had, you know, politicians that have, you know, taken money under the table and have gotten rich. And we've always had, you know, the railroad barons of the 19th century who cut sweetheart deals with the government. Should we even really care about this? And I think you can probably guess, given the fact that I wrote a book about it, that my answer is absolutely yes. I think this is the profound issue that we face in America in the 21st century. So let's talk about politicians first. America is supposed to be governed by self-governance, the notion that we send individuals to Washington who are supposed to represent ourselves, and it is supposed to be in some form a citizen legislature. Well, about 60, 70 years ago, that started changed, and we have a situation now where elected officials can not only come and perform public service, but they come and perform public service relatively middle class. And they leave very, very wealthy. Let me give you two recent examples from people, one from each party, because this is a bipartisan issue. I believe that this is a problem of human nature, not of one political party or the other. The first one would be Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House from San Francisco. When she first came into Congress in 1987, her net worth was around $3 million. In the 20 years she had served in Congress after that, her net worth has gone up 876%. Which means if you do it on a compounded basis, you're averaging about 24% return on your investment every year. I think George Soros or Warren Buffett or certainly me would kill for that kind of return on investment. So a dramatic increase in wealth. And I'm going to argue that at least part of that, a large part of that, is connected to her political position. What about a Republican? Well, the Speaker of the House immediately before her was Dennis Hastert from Illinois. Dennis Hastert, when he became Speaker in the late 1990s, had a net worth around $300,000. When he left as Speaker less than a decade later, it was in the millions. It could potentially have been as high as $11 million. He didn't inherit money. He didn't win the lotto. It's a function of him leveraging his position in order to enrich himself. Those are two individuals, but there are multiple others that I talk about in the book. I name people from both political parties, and this information comes from their public financial disclosures and comparing their activities with what they're working on in terms of legislation, what access they might have to sensitive information. So How does this work? How is it that elected officials are able to leverage their position and make money? Well, the first example I would give is the IPO, which I would consider simply a form of legalized bribery. And let me just give you an example of this. Let's say John is in the United States Senate, and I come into his office, and I need a favor. And I say, John, I need a favor. Here's a shoebox with $10,000 cash. I appreciate your help. What's going to happen? Well, if we get caught, we're going to go to jail. That's bribery. I'm giving him cash in exchange for a good. That doesn't happen so much in Washington anymore. You hear about the occasional gentleman like Congressman Jefferson who put $90,000 in his freezer. But that's the exception to the rule. And frankly, that form of illegal graft is really small potatoes. You can make a lot more money if you play it right, engaging what I consider legal graft. So now let's assume I go into Senator John's office, but instead of bringing a shoebox of cash, I say, John, I need a favor. I'm concerned about a piece of legislation. And, you know, by the way, I'm involved with this company, and I'm going to give you access to initial public offering shares of stock. And you're going to be able to buy these at $20 a share. And then the next day when they go public, they're going to sell for at least $50 a share. And you can turn around and sell them the next day, and you can make $100,000. That's perfectly legal. And that scenario goes on quite frequently in Washington, D.C. And here's the challenging part. When congressmen and senators engage in initial public offering purchases of stock, they don't have to disclose it as such. They simply list it as another stock transaction. So when you're going through financial disclosure forms, the only way you can find out whether they received these secret IPO shares is by literally looking at the date of their purchase and seeing if that was before it was publicly available for the rest of us. This is what happened in the case of the Nancy Pelosi IPO that I talk about in my book and that you may recall was a subject of the 60 Minutes episode a couple of weeks ago.
And now for something completely different.